As Florida's COVID cases soar, where are the contact tracers? Good Monday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. And just ahead this morning, how researchers are trying to help improve the state's testing and tracing efforts. What are your questions about this? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Then later, a closer listen to WJCT's new all-news talk format and how you can still access the music you love. But first this hour, the latest on the coronavirus pandemic in Florida by the numbers. We are very sorry to tell you that Florida broke a record over the weekend with a new tally of 15,300 new coronavirus cases reported Sunday alone. That is the most by any state in a single day. In Florida alone, we have many more positive cases than many nations around the world. In our area, we are close to 18,000 cases and 142 deaths so far, including five in Duval County. That's a single-day high for this county. Now, these dismal numbers have critics of Florida's COVID response calling for everything from a statewide mask order, which the governor refuses to do, to more aggressive contact tracing. Now, speaking of the masks, over the weekend, the Jacksonville RNC host committee held an event featuring Vice President Mike Pence. A couple of public officials tweeted pictures from that soiree showing people in attendance not wearing masks, including the vice president. This appeared to be in violation of Jacksonville's citywide mask order. Unfortunate to see this, since we know that universal mask wearing can drive down COVID infection rates. Contact tracing is very effective, too. It helps health officials determine where the virus has spread and who needs to be tested and quarantined. So far, Florida has done a pretty poor job of contact tracing. Now, there's a research effort underway to try to improve the state's response. Jacqueline Evans, PhD, is Associate Professor of Psychology at Florida International. She's part of a research project at the university that has been testing how to make contact tracing more effective and efficient. And she's on the line. Dr. Evans, good to have you on the show. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And what are your questions, callers, about the state's contact tracing program? Call us up now, 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Our Facebook page is open. First, Dr. Evans, can you explain to people who haven't followed this closely what contact tracing is and how it works?
So the basic idea of contact tracing is if somebody is tested positive, somebody should be giving them a call to chat with them about a few different things. And the thing I'm most interested in that they're going to talk about on that phone call is who that person has had contact with while they were infectious, meaning who did you see when you could have spread COVID? And so typically what they're going to do is ask you maybe who you live with, and who you've been in close proximity to since maybe a couple days before you started showing symptoms. And you would provide those names, and then those names you provided, each of those individuals should be getting a phone call to let them know they've been exposed. And then they should be told that they should self-quarantine until they're either able to get a test to confirm whether they're positive or not, or for about 14 days. And what that allows you to do is contain the infection. So ideally, you would catch these people before they, too, are infectious. And so you keep those people from further spreading COVID.
It's a way to contain the virus. We've heard reports from all over the state that we don't have nearly enough contact tracers doing this kind of work. What do we know about the state's program? Where are contact tracers out there doing this work?
You know, I don't know the details of exactly what's happening in the state right now, but I can't imagine that there are enough contact tracers right now. I mean, you referenced the fact that we broke a record very recently in Florida, not one to be proud of, with over 15,000 cases. That's 15,000 phone calls that need to be made, and nobody has a staff ready to go to make 15,000 phone calls a day. So it's definitely kind of an overwhelming task for the contact tracers out there.
And so even if it might be too little, too late to fix this, tell us about the research project you're working on at Florida International University. It would improve contact tracing, yes?
Yes. So we did some preliminary work a few years ago that showed that if you incorporate some of the techniques that we know are effective in other interviewing contexts, so for example, there's a lot of research on how to interview a witness to a crime, for example. We've done research on that for years. So if you take some of the methods from that world and apply it to the contact tracing world, we showed that you can actually improve or increase the number of contacts people are able to remember. And so now we were lucky enough to get some funding from the National Science Foundation to do a study that has a few different goals. So one is to, again, take some of those methods that we know work in witness interviewing contexts and test them in a contact tracing context. And what we're also interested in is trying to test what we're calling a self-led interview. So in other words, instead of having an interviewer on the phone asking you questions about who you've had contact with, instead you would go through perhaps an online survey that would lead you through those questions instead. And one of the benefits of that would be, we were just talking about how manpower is a little limited right now with thousands and thousands of phone calls. So if you can take some of the burden off of those contact tracers, so they might still be making phone calls, talking to you about your symptoms, how to self-quarantine, but then they can sort of offload that memory piece where they're asking you to remember who you had contact with. That means that they can get off the phone quicker and get onto their next phone call quicker. So a big part of our research is testing whether or not that self-led interview is effective.
And what's the timetable for this project? When do you anticipate to have some results to show?
So we've started data collection this summer. So we're hopeful that we will have some at least preliminary data maybe by early September. That's the hope. And it's actually we're doing two different studies. So the first study, we're just looking at adults. So that's where we'll have that preliminary data in the fall. But we're also going to be doing a second study where we're in particular also interested in age. So we'll be testing children and the elderly in addition to adults to see if our methods are effective for those age groups.
Once you have this data, do you plan to present it to the governor, state health officials, to try to make a positive impact on the pandemic here?
We would be happy to present our results to anybody who wants to listen to us. We really hope that this does have an impact and that people will start to adopt some of the methods that we're recommending. While we haven't tested our most recent protocol, it's, you know, ongoing right now. Everything we know about investigative interviewing would suggest that this is going to be effective, including our own preliminary data that was published a few years ago. So we're happy to, anybody who wants to talk to us, we're happy to give them some tips on how to improve the interviewing process.
And as we speak with Dr. Jacqueline Evans of FIU, what are your questions about the new research project looking at contact tracing in Florida? 549-2937. Lisa is in Neptune Beach. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Oh, I mean, I was just wondering because I have 30 years experience in education. I have two master's degrees, and I'm unemployed and trying very hard to find a job. I've applied to no less than 5 contract tracing positions, and I haven't heard a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering why, if there are so few contact tracers who need jobs, why somebody who, I mean, I feel like I would be very qualified to do that job, and why they're not hiring.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot, Lisa, that people have inquired about these jobs and haven't been able to get any information. Thanks for the call, and I'm sorry to hear you're struggling with that. Dr. Evans, this is a proven way to contain the virus. It would also put a lot of people back to work that need jobs right now. And so what about the fact that people are having a hard time even getting information about contact tracing positions in Florida, and there doesn't seem to be a widespread effort to employ people to do this?
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. I have to agree. It's not ideal. I can assume that there's a funding issue, and that's probably part of the issue. And as well, it's sort of a semi-last-minute sort of situation. So I don't know what their process is for hiring, but it definitely sounds like it could be improved if it's hard to find information to begin with.
We're still trying to determine if they're doing any contact tracing in Duval County, I should point out. A few folks have contacted us and said that they tried to apply for those jobs here in Jacksonville, but were encouraged instead to apply over in Gainesville. We don't know if there are any active contact tracers in this city or not. We're trying to get that information. It's 549-2937. Give us a call. Nick on the West Side. Hello, Nick. Good morning.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question. I mean, in regards to what you were just saying about how it's, we're limited on contact tracing and it's we're unsure if it's even happening in Duval. Are there any resources that we as the public can use to be a little more proactive as opposed to waiting for somebody to call that we can reach out and try? Is there a database or some way we can start the process ourselves?
Do you mean independent contact tracing, independent of the state's apparatus?
Exactly. Is there a way for us to kind of get the information out there, any resources that we can use as opposed to being proactive as the public?
Thanks, Nick. You know, Dr. Evans, that's a great question from him. But honestly, it really does take a massive government effort to do this kind of thing properly. A CNN investigation suggests Florida health officials are failing to conduct contact tracing in COVID-19 cases. The CDC says contact tracing is key to slowing the spread of coronavirus. The CNN report on this found that if Florida were adequately staffing to the guidelines that the CDC recommends, they would be employing nearly 7,000 people as contact tracers. And so that's the kind of effort to do adequately that you really need government to do.
Yeah, and I would just add, I love this question. and there, it's not going to have maybe the huge effect that a concerted government effort would have, but obviously if you test positive, you can start thinking about who you had contact with as soon as you get that positive test. You don't have to wait till you get a phone call. You can start thinking about it right away. Write down all the names you can think of. It'll be easier to think of those names from a memory standpoint, you know, a few days after you had contact, as opposed to waiting potentially several days before getting a phone call. In addition, you can make sure you don't think about the names one time and that write them down and then that be the end of it. If you really want to remember as many people as possible, what we know from memory is you should try to search your memory multiple times. So it won't necessarily have a huge impact statewide, but it might have a big impact for the people that you remember. So I would absolutely encourage you.
You would encourage that. Do your own version of it to answer his question.
If you feel comfortable doing that, you could even reach out to people if you're feeling comfortable to let them know that they've been exposed.
Our own mayor, Lenny Curry, here in Jacksonville is quarantining because he was exposed to someone who tested positive. He's self-quarantining out of an abundance of caution. So that's one example. 549-2937, Ted in Mandarin. Hi, Ted.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is related to what Nick said a couple minutes ago. He was asking about what could be done proactively. I'm looking at it a little bit differently. I think that there has to be a way for us to link up as concerned citizens with people who are professionally involved, people who are medically, you know, involved in this effort to deal with the COVID-19. And is there a way for us to reach out to those people or make our voices heard so that we can say, look, this needs to be done, and we're not simply going to sit here quietly waiting for somebody else to do it until the crisis has gone way far than it needs to be gone. Is there any way for us to do something about it ourselves?
Ted, thank you for that call. Dr. Evans, you hear callers saying, look, I want to help. I want to do something. What do you advise them to do?
I wish I had great tips for you. I don't know who you could reach out to help other than to just, be as proactive as you can within your own life. So making sure that you pay attention to who you have contact with throughout kind of your day-to-day life. That's one way to be proactive. So as soon as you have an issue where, you know, you hopefully not, but you test positive, you already have those names ready to go to either contact yourself or to communicate to somebody else. But I am not aware of a method where you can reach out to anyone, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, you can try the health department and try to apply to be a contact tracer. But as we've heard from several listeners, that's easier said than done. They're not getting through. You know,
exactly.
Dr. Evans, let me ask you about an upcoming event here in Jacksonville. Now, you're down in South Florida. Up here in our area, of course, in several weeks, Jacksonville is slated to host the Republican National Convention. And if it's held indoors, as is currently planned, at Vistar Veterans Arena, thousands of people are going to be packed into an enclosed space for several hours, which is seen as the highest risk event possible for spreading coronavirus. How on earth can you contact trace if somebody turns up positive with COVID after an event like that? How do you even attempt to contact trace after something like that, which flies in the face of all medical recommendations?
Yeah, it has the potential to be a mess. I would be lying if I said otherwise. Obviously, in some situations, it's hard to track down maybe the person you were standing next to, for example, at an event like that, or the people within your 6-foot radius or 10-foot radius. What they most likely would do is instead, I'm guessing, put out more of a general statement saying somebody who was at this event has tested positive, and that would communicate to anybody watching the news that they should be aware of potential exposure. But you're right, it's a very, very difficult task when you start getting into these really large groups.
And it will only worsen spread of the virus in Florida, which is an epicenter. That said, we do need to point out that only a handful of states around the country are seen as adequately approaching contact tracing. It's difficult even under the best of circumstances, isn't it?
Oh, it's very difficult, and this is unprecedented. This is not a career where you normally have hundreds of contact tracers standing by. So not only do you not have the staff now as they're trying to hire people, which again, there are budget issues with that, but they also are ideally training these people, but there's so little time because they need to get them on the phone. So it's difficult in general because memory is a tricky thing. Sometimes people don't even want to tell you the answers to your questions, and that's a whole other issue. Sometimes they don't answer the phone. That's another issue. But even once you get them on the phone, it's not all that straightforward that they're going to remember everything you ask. And again, now you throw in these are inexperienced contact tracers because they were just hired. And yeah, it's an extremely complicated situation.
Right. I mean, if I tested positive for COVID, I would have a very difficult time remembering every single person I've come into contact with over the last couple of weeks. You know, there's the grocery store. I went into a dry cleaners with my mask on. I've driven through the Panera drive-thru. I don't know who handed me my food through that window. I mean, that would be very difficult. There's no way I could isolate and remember every individual.
Yeah, no, it's extremely difficult, and that's why we're trying to come up with methods that will maximize your ability to remember all those people. I will say it is important to remember that just because you had a 30-second interaction with someone doesn't necessarily mean that that's who the contact tracer is interested in. They're definitely going to be interested in the people that you had the closest contact with.
And for longer periods of time, right?
Exactly. So even if you were within 6 feet, but you were only within 6 feet for 30 seconds to a minute having a quick exchange, the risk of transmission is very low. So they may allow you to tell them that name if you remember it, but they're going to be much more concerned with the person who sits next to you at work, the person you've been in a vehicle with, who you sat next to at an event. Those are the people that they're going to be more concerned with because the risk of transmission is much higher the longer you spend with someone.
All right. That's helpful to know. And lots of comments on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Lisa writes, why didn't they start this back in January? Why didn't they have a better plan in place? If you fail to plan, you plan to fail. How much longer must we deal with such incompetence? You know, Dr. Evans, the state of Florida's leadership has come in for a huge amount of criticism for the way we've handled the pandemic. But that said, governors around the country are having to try to figure out what to do piecemeal, because at the heart of the matter is the massive failure at the federal level to get a handle on this pandemic at the outset, which is why we are where we are now and why I'm sitting here talking to you as you research how to help the state do this better.
Yeah, no, it's an even more complicated situation now. Obviously, if we could have really tackled this with excellent contact tracing and lots of testing early on, then we probably would not be in this position and having quite the same phone call right now.
549-2937, Susan in Mandarin. Hi, Susan.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, does contact tracing also mean how people got it? And because has Mayor Curry said where he was exposed? I think these kinds of questions would help us learn if masks are helping, if people are getting it outside. And also, why not ask the people these questions when before they get the test? Like, where have they been with a mask? Where have they been without a mask? And put all that in a database once it comes back positive. I know there's lots of privacy issues. I would kind of freak out if somebody called me on the phone that I didn't know. So, okay, thank you.
Sure. Lots of good questions there from Susan. Dr. Evans.
Yeah, I'll try to remember all of them. I definitely remember the most recent one. Why don't we ask people who they had contact with when they go to get tested? And from a memory standpoint, I love that idea. I think that would be great. As I alluded to before, it's easier to remember things that are more recent. So if you start feeling bad and go get tested, you're much more likely to remember the people that you've interacted with over the last 2 days. But if you don't get a phone call for, let's say, 3 days, now you have to remember 5 days back, right? That's much more difficult. In addition, just going through the process of trying to remember your contacts at that initial testing point can actually help you to remember more when you do get a phone call later. So I think that's a great idea. And I have forgotten the first part of her question.
Well, hopefully that helped somewhat. Candace on the South Side. Hi, Candace. You're on the air.
Hi, Melissa. I just wanted to let you and the callers know that are interested in doing something now. There's a free class online from Johns Hopkins. It's a 6-hour class that teaches you how to be a contact tracer. You get a certificate. It's free. And while you're waiting for our program to get up and running, you can learn how to do it.
That's great, Candace. Thanks for that. And so, Dr. Evans, people hopefully will take advantage of that. But then, of course, they have to get the state to pick them up and hire them. And as you said, there's not a lot of funding to deploy contact tracers to the level that we need.
Yes, agreed. It is an interesting course. I actually know the course she's referring to. I took it myself. And it is useful even just as a person living life to kind of get a sense of, okay, well, how long does it take? Like, what is the infectious period? If I'm going to quarantine, how long should I quarantine? So it is actually, I found it to be interesting from that point of view. But keep in mind, the state right now is hiring on the order of hundreds of contact tracers, to my knowledge, and not on the order of thousands. So great as it would be if everybody went and got trained, they're not going to be hiring thousands and thousands anytime soon, even if that is what we need.
Mary in San Jose. Hi, Mary. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. I am in my early 60s, as is my husband, and I would like to visit a friend, and mostly we've been pretty much isolating, but I would like to visit a friend, and she lives alone. I was wondering if that's a safe thing to do. My husband does have diabetes and high blood pressure, so that, and both of us are a little bit both of us are overweight. And so if we do the 6 feet away and masks, is that safe or is that risky?
Yes. Great question, Mary, and I'm so glad you asked it. Thank you, Mary. That's Mary in San Jose. Dr. Evans, what do you advise Mary and her husband to do?
Well, first, I should preface this with I am not a medical doctor. I am not an infectious disease expert. But what I do know suggests that you said she lives alone. If she lives alone and really hasn't been interacting with anyone else, then it's probably a reasonable thing to go and visit her, especially if you're wearing masks, staying 6 feet away. I would say ideally if there's a way you can sit outdoors. I know it's hot in Florida, but if there's a way you can sit outside, that would be even better. But it sounds like a pretty safe situation, but you just want to take every possible precaution given
yes.
you know, there's the potential for being particularly vulnerable.
Great advice.
Well.
And, you know, we just got an email from Rebecca. She is a physician at Baptist, she says. She writes, the rule of thumb for significant contact used in Taiwan and South Korea is this. More than 15 minutes of contact within 6 feet, especially if no mask is used. So contract tracers are interested in people you've been around for more than 15 minutes, closer than 6 feet, and no mask. So for Mary, the caller, try to stay outside, stay 6 feet away, wear a mask, and keep the visit short. Those are the ways we can all protect ourselves, because as we've been learning, indoor contact for a long period of time in close proximity with no mask, that is how the virus spreads. So, Dr. Evans, I want to thank you so much for your time, and please do keep us posted on this study.
Absolutely. Thank you again for having me.
She's Dr. Jacqueline Evans, FIU Associate Professor of Psychology. And much more still ahead. Later, a preview of this year's Jax by Jax Literary Arts Festival and how you can apply to be part of it. Plus, small business and the pandemic. As bars are essentially closed, a local brewery is raided by ATF agents. What happened? We'll take a closer look after this.
Dig, research, question, repeat. That's what we do every week on Reveal.
I have here thousands of pages of documentation of murder.
I'm Al Edson, host of Reveal, the weekly radio show from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Reveal, because there's always more to the story.
Saturday afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Sky LeBron, and I'm a reporter here, and I really like talking to new people. There's nothing like being able to get outside the city to tell a story. I remember sitting down with the former mayor of Green Cove Springs, and we were at his coffee shop. He's working with his coffee roasting equipment, and then he's also turning around and talking to me about policy and city changes. We try to amplify all the voices of Northeast Florida here at WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, if you're a writer looking for bigger exposure for your work, now is the time to submit it to the Jax by Jax Literary Arts Festival. I learned more from festival organizer Darlin Kuhn. Darlin, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
So tell us about Jax by Jax Literary Arts Festival and how writers can apply to it.
Well, there's an application process, and it's open from July 1st to July 31st, and it's a festival celebrating Jacksonville writers writing Jacksonville. And what that means is if you were born in Jacksonville, if you live here now, or if your main subject matter is about Jacksonville, you're welcome to apply. Every year we've had a in-person wonderful festival. It started in 2014 in separate venues throughout the Park and King area in Riverside. And last year we moved it downtown to the Jacksonville Public Library and the Museum of Contemporary Art. But this year, due to health concerns and the COVID-19 pandemic, we've decided that we're going to do a two-hour documentary.
Hmm.
And so that's the exciting news. Instead of it being just one day where you can all get together and celebrate writers, we're going to have two watch parties. One's going to be on Saturday, October 17th, from noon to 3 p.m., and the other's going to be on the next day, Sunday, October 18th, from 7 p.m. to 10 p.m., and then we're going to post it online so that people who missed either of those opportunities can watch it. And so it'll just be up there to enjoy after that date.
What kinds of writing are you asking people to submit?
Well, usually we just look out there and say, okay, Jacksonville's full of talented writers. Let's see what they have on their minds, what they've published recently. But 2020 is a pretty special year. We've got, you know, the pandemic happening, the social justice protests. People are worried about climate change and unemployment, and there's the whole politics with the election year. People are isolated. There are also lots of wonderful positive things happening as far as people, you know, human reaction to that. So what we'd like to do is ask people to give us their thoughts about the year 2020. How is this affecting you? What are your thoughts and feelings? Because you know, history is written by the people who win wars. That's what ends up in the history books. But the real truth is told by poets and writers that are witnessing events and writing things down. So we're looking for fresh new writing. If people want to submit something that they've already done, we'll look it over. The selection committee will consider it. But we're really, really excited about, what do you think about the year 2020?
Hmm. I'm sure you're going to get some very interesting applications because people, I think, do have a lot to say right now. You need to go to, everybody, jacksbyjacks.com for the Jacks by Jacks Literary Art Festival. They are accepting applications from writers through the end of this month with the online debut and watch party scheduled for October 17th and 18th and a student showcase. Lots of fun with this literary arts festival. And kudos to you, darling. You and your husband, Brad, have put this together and we're excited to see it happening again this year. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, buying alcohol remains a to-go-only option at Florida bars right now and for the foreseeable future as coronavirus cases continue to spike. Governor DeSantis says the state is not going to change its decision to keep bars shut down to in-person customers. It's to-go-only. Now, understandably, that's made it tough for businesses like craft breweries. They're struggling to comply with the state's rules on serving customers in the middle of this pandemic as they work to try to stay afloat. One local establishment actually got a visit from armed ATF agents late last week, and a Facebook post on the incident went viral. Preben Olson is co-owner of Aardwolf Brewery in San Marco, and he joins us now. Preben Olson, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you on the line. Okay, so what happened? You got a visit from ATF? What all went down?
Did, and I'd just like to start off by saying whether or not you're for or against bars being open, this most recent shutdown actually allowed anyone who has a 509 serving license to remain open. That's just a food service license, and they dropped a 50% requirement that allows
And I'm sorry for that beeping. Someone's trying to call in. I apologize for that. Keep on going, yeah. Preben.
Yeah, no problem. So the 50% requirement says that 50% or more of your revenue needs to come from food. With that dropped, a bar that sells nachos is now considered a restaurant. And they can actually have less restrictions. So we've kind of been yelling at the DBPR for a while. And we got a visit because we specifically said we were looking at what they have called themselves the cigar bar exemption.
No. Oh, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm kind of having connection.
Is it someone trying to call in on your phone, maybe?
I'm not getting any sort of any signs there, no.
Okay. You know what, Previn? We're going to take a quick break and come back. Stand by. Stand by 1 second.
Yeah, certainly. Sorry.
Okay, everyone, we're back now with Previn Olson, co-owner at Aardwolf Brewery in San Marco, which was raided by armed ATF agents last week, or at least visited, I should say. Previn, if you could pick up where you left off, why did this happen again?
Certainly. Sorry about that. So we were visited last week specifically as we asked the state if we could be open on
and
our
I can't believe it. We're getting this beeping again. I have no idea why. Previn, I am so sorry. We're just going to have to suffer through this. Keep talking.
Okay. Sorry. So we got a visit as we asked for if we could fall under a cigar bar exemption. Cigar bars are allowed to remain open right now. Since cigars are considered non-alcoholic sales. It's kind of odd, but they have the same licensing as bars and breweries. And we immediately got a raid within a day. And sadly, this is not the first raid we've heard about from the ABT, which is the alcohol division arm of the DBPR. So it seems like they're just kind of using what limited resources they have to push back against any breweries that are speaking out against them right now.
Do you feel you were unfairly targeted?
I do, yes.
Okay.
And I feel specifically our industry is being unfairly targeted.
You feel you're being scapegoated for the issues that we're dealing with as a whole?
Well, yeah, we are. And, you know, Jacksonville made public news as outbreaks at bars across the beaches kind of got hit with these big COVID outbreaks. But the catch is under the DBPR's recent shutdown, those places serve, you know, nachos and chicken wings, and they're still allowed to be open. They aren't restaurants. They're just bars with food, and they're allowed to remain open because of this, like, 509 licensing that they have allowed to remain in place.
And so now could you maybe, I know some establishments that serve alcohol in this city are remaining open because they're serving food. They've added up, they've beefed up their menu so that they can stay open. Is that something you're considering?
That is something we're considering. We're looking at it. We don't want to change our license per se. And the DBPR is actually expediting all these. What normally takes 30 days for the licensing, they're pushing through at about two to three days at the moment because they realize that the rulings are so arbitrary. So it's kind of interesting that they are allowing expedited services to get around their own rules that are in place.
Okay. Let me ask you too, you know, we do know that this virus is spread mainly at restaurants and bars.
people in close contact, chit-chatting, no masks, having drinks or food for a long period of time, primarily younger people. So what about the argument that's been made that the epicenters of the virus are in places like Aardwolf and that they need to be strictly monitored?
Well, fortunately for me, DeSantis went on record in Bradenton on Saturday saying that South Florida's three counties that did not go to phase two, where restaurants remained at 25% and bars were closed, are having the same explosive growth and positivity rates. So there's no correlation between this.
So what's the plan then at Aardwolf to keep your doors open? Tell us what you're going to be doing going forward.
So we are currently at to-go sales only, which is what we've been doing for 50% of the year to date. We're doing, you know, six-packs, growlers, merchandise, anything and everything we can. It's just gotten a lot harder with the second shutdown as most bars remain open. People usually come in, are confused that they are not allowed to drink and leave and go down the street and have a beer. So we're doing the same thing we've been doing for 3.5 months, but it's just getting a little harder every day as people kind of grow weary. And unfortunately, there's no federal funding. There's no kind of help in sight. We're just kind of out
were
on
you,
our own.
Were you able to get a PPP loan, a paycheck protection loan?
So we were, you know, and that was supposed to be good for 2.5 months. Bars in particular, it wasn't really designed for us. So we only had about a month and a half's worth of financing. So, you know, two months after that, we're still closed down.
I see. And, you know, the craft brewery scene is a big driver of neighborhoods. It's an economic engine. So how can people help your business right now, aside from purchasing products to go?
Our biggest push at the moment is just reach out to your local legislators. Ask them why specifically, you know, if you're going to go and try to shut down the market, you need to shut down the market, limit hours, limit licenses. Or if you're going to open it all up, you need to open it all up. Wherever you stand, we are just asking to be treated fairly.
Well, I want to thank you for joining us. He's Preben Olson, co-owner of Aardwolf Brewery, microbrewery in San Marco. They are open for to-go orders, so try to patronize your locally owned businesses like Aardwolf that are struggling in this pandemic. Thanks so much for being with us and keep in touch, okay?
Great. Thanks for having me.
A quick break, and in a moment, we speak with our CEO, David McGowan, and take a closer listen to our new all-news talk format here on 89.9. We'll be right back.
In the wake of the civil rights movement, James Baldwin, with both anger and love, documented the work that still needed to be done. Princeton professor Eddie Glaude Jr. joins us to talk about looking at today's racism through Baldwin's eyes, the subject of his book, Begin Again, James Baldwin's America and its Urgent Lessons for Our Own. That's next time on Think. Tonight at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Join WJCT and the Northeast Florida Regional Council for an ADAPT conversation with a panel of experts focusing on the parallels between and the intersections of climate change and the coronavirus and how these crises are affecting our state and region. This virtual event on Tuesday, July 14th at 7 p.m. is free. Reservations are required. For more information, visit wjct.org/events.
From Robert Johnson to B.B. King, from Stevie Ray Vaughan to Gary Clark Jr., the best in classic and modern blues can be found on Blues Horizon every Sunday night at 7 on WJCT 89.9 HD3.
At a time when many are asking questions about the future direction of the country, can we take some cues from the kitchen? Top Chef host Padma Lakshmi thinks we can. She says that's where we first sample the cultural mashup that's often described as American food. Padma Lakshmi on Melting Pots and Cooking Pots, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, today it's an important change here on the radio for all of us here at 89.9 as we convert our daily programming to all news talk with some exciting new shows to check out. And at the same time, you can still find all of the music you love. Our CEO, David McGowan, is on the line with more. Hey, David. Hey, David. Hey, David. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Great to be with you this Monday morning.
Good to have you. And we're excited here to make a switch on 89.9 to responding to what our listeners say they overwhelmingly want more of, which is news and information, and while also keeping music programs alive. This is a big change.
It is. It's actually the culmination. Today marks the culmination of a change that we've been working on for several months. And as you mentioned, Melissa, the first thing that we did was to build a new home for the music that we offer at WJCT. And in fact, today we offer more music than we ever have before. But we did that so that we could accommodate some new programming on this station, WJCT News 89.9. And that includes, you know, 13 new programs across the schedule, in addition to more local newscasts. So we're excited about those changes, and we're just continuing to look, as you mentioned, to ways to serve listeners with what we know that they want.
Right. And now this decision wasn't made hastily. We got a lot of feedback from listeners out there about this before we made the change, right?
We did. We've done some surveys of our listeners and of our members, and we've asked them a range of questions about what it is they want from WJCT and what they want from us on the radio. And we understand that it's very hard to operate a real mixed format radio station in 2020. So we have made this change for a number of reasons, including listener feedback, but also because we understand that there is a crisis in local news across the country, particularly in local newspapers. We are not immune from that here in Jacksonville. We love our news partner, the Times Union, but of course they are subject to commercial pressures that are even more pronounced now in 2020. And so we believe that it's our job to do our part and to help fill the gap and to expand our local news reporting and our local news services, in addition to providing that mix of national programming, of national news programming that we know our listeners respond to and love. So we have acted and made a formatting change. It's a gradual change. As I said, it's something that's taken place over a month. Hopefully listeners are not finding it today particularly disruptive. It's very much, I think, in keeping with what listeners have come to expect from the station. But we're excited about it.
Right. And during the day, most of the shows people love and listen to regularly will remain the same. The big changes will be after hours. Can you talk a little bit more about
that?
That's
right. It's really in the... That's right. It's in the evening. I think probably the most prominent and exciting new change during the week is a program that we just heard a promo to coming into this segment, a program called Think. And I know that your listeners had the opportunity to hear from the host of that program, Chris Boyd. It's a program comes out of Dallas that we're excited to add to our schedule evenings at 10. We're also adding a radio version of the PBS NewsHour, which we're excited to add, one of the most respected news programs in the country by all you know, parts of the political spectrum. So, you know, we're excited to add those programs to our daily schedule. And then on the weekend, we have programs like It's Been a Minute, New Yorker Radio Hour, the podcast playlist, a whole series of new programs, 13 overall, as I mentioned.
Right. And as you said at the start of our discussion here, people that love the Electro Lounge and other music shows that we produce here at the station can still access them through our app and online and through our HD channels.
Yeah, that's right. And it's really very exciting to be able to expand the Electro Lounge, a program which has been on the air, the creation of David Luckin has been on the air for, you know, more than 15 years. And one of the things that we set as a criteria for this whole project was making sure that we were able to serve listeners of our kind of handcrafted music services in ways that were even better than what they've been able to receive before. So we've expanded Electro Lounge to a brand new 24/7 service, Electro Lounge Radio. Listeners and lovers of that program can, you know, get their Electro Lounge dose any time of day, all day long. So we're terrifically excited about that. As you said, Melissa, it's available through our app, online streaming, and on HD4.
So check it out online and keep listening on the radio at 89.9 as we make this shift that you, the listeners, asked for to all news talk on our main radio channel. And thank you so much. He's on the line too, CEO David McGowan. Have a great week, David. Thanks.
Thank you, Melissa.
That's our show. Thanks for listening. And thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Jessica Blumbo is station news director, and our digital editor is Bill Bortsfield. Keep those emails coming, meanwhile. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 or our podcast. You can pick that up wherever you download yours. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow and connect with you then. Keep wearing your masks.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.